She wore blue velvet.
As we think about the formality of the upcoming inauguration on Monday, let's take you back to a time in U.S. history, back in the 1960s, when a momentous transfer of power occurred without any forethought, without ritual, and without inauguration at all. The whimsical bubblegum 60s were interrupted in 1963 by a bullet.
I didn't have reports of shots being fired.
We had reports, yes, sir.
Young John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Texas, and his much older successor, Vice President Lyndon Johnson, a Texan, took the oath of office a few hours later.
We have suffered a loss that cannot be waived. I will do my best. That is all I can do.
A stark, sudden transfer of power with no real script, few formalities, and the first such transfer in the nuclear age.
One of the things that he showed is his just true leadership ability. I mean, he really just stepped up to the task immediately.
That is Mark Updegrove, the director of the majestic and newly remodeled LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. A tall marble building, part document archive, part oddball collection, part video game.
So this, John, is a called an interactive table, and it's meant to show not only what LBJ accomplished legislatively, but its impact on your life.
It's where the historical record of that remarkable transfer of power is kept, as well as the entire history of Lyndon Johnson's rise as a politician. LBJ, Updegrove says, had the perfect training for this moment of suddenly taking power in the midst of chaos.
He had been around power for many years as a congressman, as a senator, as probably the most powerful Senate majority leader. One of the things that Lady Bird Johnson said about Lyndon Johnson is he was a good man to have around in an emergency.
But he stepped into this role at a moment of almost powerlessness,
yeah,
as a vice president, as someone who... There was even talk that he wouldn't be on the ticket in 1964.
You're right, but he also exercised power with reflexive ease, and you see that in his Senate days in particular. He knew how to get things done. He knew how to mobilize people.
A good many people told me that they heard about your statement, I guess, on TV, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
I've been locked up in this office, and I haven't seen it, but I won't tell you how grateful I am and how worthy I'm going to try to be of all your hopes.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so happy to hear that, and I knew that you had just that great spirit, and you know you have.
That is the actual voice from recordings in the LBJ Library of President Lyndon Johnson speaking with Martin Luther King right after the assassination, soliciting King's support and promising that as president, he would deliver on the Civil Rights Bill.
And we got a Civil Rights Bill and hadn't even passed the House, but I'm going to ask the Congress Wednesday to just stay there till they pass them all. They won't do it, but we'll just keep them there next year till they do, and we just won't give up an inch.
It's hard to imagine today, but Johnson, the author of the Great Society program, was not seen as a credible liberal, a real progressive, or even sincere about civil rights back in 1963. He had to prove himself, and when he tried up on Capitol Hill, old anti-civil rights allies pushed back.
Perhaps my favorite story about LBJ is when he's trying to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. And his old friend, Senator from Georgia, Richard Russell, comes to the Oval Office, and they have a very somber meeting. This is a former mentor to LBJ, a dear friend. But he's also a staunch opponent of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And he says to LBJ, you know, you can pass this act. JFK couldn't have done it, but you can. But I warn you, if you do, you will risk losing the southern states to the Republicans, and you will risk losing the election of 1964. And LBJ patiently listens to this and looks at his old friend and says, if that is the price for this bill, I will gladly pay it.
Johnson did not lose the election in 1964. The Democrats did eventually lose the South, though. But Russell, or not even Johnson, would have predicted who would become this nation's 44th president.
I think there's no question that without the sweep of civil rights legislation that LBJ passed during his administration, Barack Obama would not be in office today. In particular, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which I think LBJ was more proud of than any legislation that he passed.
Johnson's lapses, though, are also here at the library. His great achievements in domestic programs, Head Start, the Voting Rights Act, not diminished, but in a way overshadowed by Vietnam.
Their objective is not the fulfillment of Vietnamese nationalism. It is to erode and to discredit America's ability to help prevent Chinese domination over all of Asia.
LBJ thought that if you didn't stand up to communist insurgency anywhere in the world, that the dominoes would continue to fall in that region. And if we didn't stave off the insurgency, there would be a bigger conflict down the line that would draw us in. And he was very aware of the lessons of Europe in 1939. And he thought, but by preventing that, he was preventing World War III from playing out.
Library Director Updegrove says in Vietnam, the old Johnson magic didn't apply anymore. In war, LBJ had to rely on something other than his own eyes and his ability to size up an adversary personally. In a sense, politically, Johnson became blind.
He prided himself on getting people to come around to his point of view or to be able to compromise with someone. He was never able to do that with Ho Chi Minh. He was never able to see him, to squeeze his arm, to talk about his grandchildren with him, you know, to get to know him personally and to strike an agreement.
Vietnam was to be Johnson's demise. He would not run in 1968, a moment in American history so much different than those promising early days, 5 years and a world away. The newly remodeled Johnson Library in Austin makes a point of reminding you what was going on in the world, in popular culture, as these dramas were playing out in the White House and in politics. But there is one place in the library, a giant echoing room, where, as you imagine what might have been back in the 1960s, you can look up and see the record of what actually happened.
There are four floors here that you can see, windows, and in those windows are the red binders with gold presidential seals on them that contain the records of the administration. And it was meant to show the transparency with which we treat our presidential administrations. It was meant to suggest that these records are not one man's. These records are for the American people, and it's meant to show their accessibility.
LBJ got his very own inauguration in 1965 after winning the presidency in the 1964 election. Here he is speaking 48 years and a day before. Barack Obama will do the very same thing in the very same place.
We are one nation and one people. Our fate as a nation and our future as a people rests not upon one citizen, but upon all citizens. That is the majesty and the meaning of this moment.
LBJ speaking. Special thanks to Mark Updegrove, director of the LBJ Library and Museum in Austin, Texas. Next time on The Takeaway, the People's Inaugural Poem Project.
Say, take my hand to the downtrodden, the lost. Sing harmonies that blend in a spectrum of love.
Thanks to Susanna in South Carolina, who tweeted that line with the hashtag PrezPoem. That's Prez with a Z. Finally, a riddle for the weekend. What do you call a story that everybody already knows about some nasty people presented at a snail's pace over many hours and involves plus-size ladies who typically hog the stage? If you said opera, you're wrong. Oprah and Lance Armstrong. Have a good weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway is produced by WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.